from the nation's capital. This is DC Public Safety. I'm your host, Leonard Sipes. Back at our microphones, Will Marling, the executive director of the National Organization for Victim Assistance, www.trinova.org. NOVA has a long history, decades-long history of protecting victims' rights. And the topic of the show today is going to be victims' issues and pretrial release. What happens when a person is arrested and then released back out to the community, and what it means to victims and victim protection. To discuss the pretrial end of it, we have Tim Murray. He is the executive director of the Pretrial Institute, the Pretrial Justice Institute, www.pretrial.org. Before we begin the show, a couple of announcements. I've been asked to promote a variety of organizations, and one is the National Reentry Resource Center. It's a project of the Bureau of Justice Assistance, Office of Justice Programs, U.S. Department of Justice. It is a comprehensive website in terms of reentry issues. You can reach them via the website, www.nationalreentryresourcecenter.org. The American Probation and Parole Association, they've asked me to promote the fact that there is an entire week in July promoting the work of parole and probation agents, not only in the United States, but throughout the world. You can reach them via their website at www.appa-net.org. And also, it's interesting, I spoke to our friends down at the Louisiana Department of Corrections. They're the only other entity in the country doing radio shows on reentry, the Louisiana Department of Corrections Division of Parole and Probation. And their web address is simply way too long for me to give out in the radio. It'll be in the show notes. And so we get back to Will Marling and Tim Murray. Welcome to DC Public Safety.
Hey, Len. Good to be with you.
Well, gentlemen,
thanks, Len. Appreciate it.
This is an interesting topic. It really is. And I can't think of anything dicier or more controversial than this issue because, Will Marling, the victims' issues are something that the entire criminal justice system should be embracing. I'm not quite sure if we embrace them to the fullest possible extent, but we are here not only for the protection of citizens. We're here, needless to say, for the protection of victims. And you and I have had a variety of discussions where the criminal justice system just is not as good as it should be in terms of protecting victims' rights. And now we have Pretrial Justice Institute Tim Murray to discuss this whole issue of pretrial. The problem is that states and local jurisdictions throughout the country are complaining bitterly. Their jails are filled to capacity. And what they're saying is that either build another jail, either invest hundreds of millions of dollars in terms of construction and operating cost, or we have to make decisions as to who we let go before trial. The more dangerous individual needs to stay. Nobody would doubt that. But the lesser offender, that means that he's going to be put out on some sort of bail or some sort of pretrial release. In the District of Columbia, we have an entire organization, the Pretrial Release Agency, Pretrial Services Agency, who's there to supervise people on pretrial. But citizens object to that. If somebody gets arrested and 3 hours later, the person is back on their block. So there's a lot of controversy involved in this. Well, did I frame all this correctly?
Yeah, I think you covered the basis pretty well. The question in the whole operation for us is, where do victims stand? How are they involved? Are their needs represented specifically, first and foremost, for safety and security? But then, of course, the approach to justice and all of those things mixed together sometimes, not clearly. And we're just constantly trying to affirm that victim's voice. You know, the Pew Institute's research regarding safety and security, the one thing that comes out in that research is that's the number one thing in all of these discussions communities agree on, and that is we want safe and secure communities. Of course, the disagreement or the discussion, if I could, you know, soften it even there, is, well, what does that look like and how does that work? And so we're looking at this pretrial justice issue and saying, what are the realities? Because most people aren't well educated on it, and I'm coming up to speed myself so that I can better serve victims.
Tim?
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about this on your broadcast, and I appreciate the opportunities that have developed with Will and with NOVA. When Will and I first started having conversations about these issues, we both shared a remarkable number of concerns. I think criminal justice professionals have done a less than adequate job in recognizing and effectively dealing with victim issues, needs, and concerns. And that's despite the fact that many localities have passed very robust victims' bills of rights and similar legislation. When you get to the bread and butter practitioner, the man or woman that are working in our courts or our jails or with our probation or parole populations, they're relatively unversed as to what services are available to victims, how victims access those services. They're relatively unversed in how to deal with victims who confront them regarding their dissatisfaction or misunderstanding of how the justice system works. The one thing that Will and I come to constant and consistent agreement regarding is the public's demand and expectation for safety. And even though we both work at organizations that on the face of it might seem fields apart in terms of our individual interests, there is congruence when we start talking about public safety. I think that victims, as you've described, Len, often don't understand how the justice system works. And I think the justice system often, these are my words, runs and hides from victims when victims raise concerns. And I think Will and I have agreed to agree to do what we can with our organizations to remedy both of those situations.
Tim, the issue here, it strikes me, is making a proper assessment of the individual within our custody on a pretrial basis, and to make sure that if the person poses a clear and present risk to a society, that that person is kept behind bars. If the person is not that clear and present risk or danger to society, alternative means need to be considered, either through monetary bail or through what we do in the District of Columbia, is actually have a government-funded organization to supervise offenders in the community on a pretrial basis. So I think the heart and soul of this, in terms of being fair to victims and fair to the larger issue of justice, is our ability to figure out who is who's dangerous and who's an acceptable risk. Am I correct?
Yeah, I think you're correct on most of that. I would probably pick apart a couple of assumptions you're making. But let me first start by saying I think that all of us expect the justice system to make sense. And in this particular part of the criminal process, it often does not. In this part of the criminal case process, if you have a pocket full of cash, regardless of how dangerous you are, you are likely to be released in almost every jurisdiction in this country except the District of Columbia and one or two others. Because in most localities in this country, cash is what's used to determine who gets out of jail and conversely who stays in jail.
Mm-hmm.
And cash on the same front does absolutely nothing to enhance or maintain community safety. Once I pay that money as someone who's been arrested to a bail bondsman, I don't get that money back if I behave, and I don't lose more money if I misbehave. That money has already changed hands, the jail door has opened, and I walk back into the community unfettered by supervision, accountability, or monitoring. The conversations that I've had with Will have focused on the need to change that paradigm. Cash is often used as a reason why the bail system is broken in this country, because it discriminates against the poor. And while that is absolutely true, what is not discussed often enough is that it also pays no service to community safety. It endangers victims. It endangers communities as a whole. Just within the last few months, there have been tragic instances where people have paid money to a bondsman shortly after arrest, the kind of scenario you described, Len, at the beginning of your show. A case just in the last 2 weeks of the man arrested in a domestic violence case. We're all familiar with the challenges associated with domestic violence. I hope we would all agree that a rational response to domestic violence is not requiring someone to give someone else a couple of $100. In this case, in Washington State, this individual charged with domestic violence pays a $2,000 bond, goes home, burns down his house with his five children in it, as well as himself. And I wish that was an isolated instance. It is not. We know that people who get arrested are problematic. Some of them pose significant dangers. We believe and support the idea that danger can be addressed, identified, and lesser degrees of danger can be transparently managed in the community rather than hide behind a dollar amount and pretend we're all safer because a dollar amount has been fixed on someone's pretrial freedom or liberty.
I'm going to brag for a second. Our pretrial services agency here in the District of Columbia, which is a federally funded agency, has a much lower failure to return rate than most pretrial service agencies throughout the country. And you know, that's a pretty decent track record, and they've been able to combine both public safety and getting the overwhelming majority of people in court to trial. But, Will, you know, again, Tim mentioned it. This is a real dichotomy for victims. This is a real dichotomy for citizens. I agree with Tim that the average person doesn't really understand the criminal justice system, and I think that's principally our fault within the criminal justice system for not being vocal enough, which is why we do these programs. But it is tough for that person to understand. I mean, you know, the person has committed a crime. As far as they're concerned, a person's guilty of sin because they watched him do it, or they were the victims themselves, and how that person could be released within hours of being arrested, as far as they're concerned, their safety is jeopardized by that release. And how we overcome that, how we explain that, well, you know, we've got limited finances. We can't keep everybody behind bars for every crime that's been committed. We have to pick and choose between the most dangerous and the people who pose an acceptable risk to public safety. That's an almost impossible concept for victims of crime to understand.
Well, sure. If you take each individual victim and look at the loss that they've experienced, the injustice that they've endured, we naturally absorb a reaction from them, an anger from them that says, you know, I'd really like something to be done, you know, about the perpetrator. We recognize that, and we certainly honor and respect it. We also try to educate victims on these issues to say, now what's realistic in the world in which we live, in the justice system in which you are now engaged, what is truly realistic? And you know, victims were sensible people, most of them, before they were victimized, and they're sensible people after they're victimized. So you can discuss these issues. I think what Tim and I have engaged on in respecting and reflecting on this issue, respecting one another, is that there are some clearly nonsensical things going on. That to say that a person and the risk that he or she poses to society is based solely on a relatively subjective monetary standard, people don't realize that's what's transpiring. They figure that there's got to be some sophisticated thought that went into determining that, and that it has some level of protection. And, you know, what we're realizing is that is just not the case. So we want to look at the issue for the sake of victims, because you go to the doctor and you want that doctor's opinion on behalf of your medical condition. Even though you might have perceptions, you might defer saying, okay, I understand that you're focused on this. So we want to be representing the needs of victims while also working sensibly to bring about meaningful change within the system. And so that's why Tim and I, you know, we're collaborating on this issue, because we believe ultimately it serves society, it serves victims, and it serves the process. We're in a period in our lives, in our culture, in our society, where finances are, they have to be considered. So now we're driven to consider these things because the jails are overcrowded, we can't build enough prisons, and so on. So this is a good time, actually, to discuss this. What truly works, what's truly meaningful in addressing the risk factors, what is sensible for serving victims.
I like your example yesterday, Will, when we were talking about this. Okay, so the guy is a major drug dealer. He's involved in organized crime. And what happens is he gets a $10,000 bail. He gets a $25,000 bail. That's a considerable amount of money. But for people involved in organized crime, it may not be. And that person posts the $25,000 bail, and the person's suddenly out. So there, the decision is not necessarily made on the dangerousness to society. It's done purely because he has access to the money.
Well, absolutely.
And if I can jump in here.
Yeah, Tim.
I think it's important for everybody who's listening to remember that our nation's courts have always dealt with the issue of danger when they set pretrial release conditions. Mm-hmm. But our traditional way of dealing with danger is setting a dollar amount and keeping our fingers crossed that the bad guy doesn't have the money. And in many cases, that turns out to be exactly the case. But decision makers never know for sure. Maurice Clemens was a defendant in Tacoma, Washington, a year and a half ago or so. They set a $190,000 bond on this guy for, I believe, child molesting, sexual molestation of, of an underage child. $190,000 bond, he pays it, and shortly thereafter he walks into a diner and shoots and kills four deputies. Now, as a result of that tragedy, the state of Washington is looking at creating legislation that resembles the legislation in the District of Columbia, and that's something that Will and I have talked about. The court should have the power to detain someone pending trial when the prosecutor makes a case rebutted by defense in an open evidentiary hearing. But when the prosecutor makes the case that this defendant is so dangerous that no condition of supervision or combination of conditions can reasonably assure appearance, then that individual, as is currently the case in D.C. and in the federal system, is held. There are some safeguards that go along with that. Their trial has to be accelerated. You can't just keep them locked up on an accusation for years at a time. But that is a fair, transparent, and rational, and I believe honest, way of dealing with an issue that the courts have always had to deal with, but have done so in a hypocritical way by pretending that a $100,000 bond is actually going to protect the community. It only protects the community if the defendant doesn't have it.
But more
and
than
in
half-
some cases, the case that Will and you discussed yesterday, those cases raise the issue in the case of a drug dealer who gets a $25,000 bond. Where did he get the money to pay the bond? And it's not unheard of in this country that defendants make deals with commercial bail bondsmen. They pay them overtime. They literally get released, go out and commit further crimes, creating more victims in order to pay the bounty for their release. It's just no way to administer justice, and it's really time to end it once and for all. And I think the voice of the victims' community is a powerful one. And when people like Will start having these conversations out loud, officials take notice and listen. And I think that that's an important conversation for officials to pay attention to.
Well, Morton, way more than halfway through the program, I want to reintroduce our guest, Will Marling, the executive director of the National Organization for Victim Assistance, www.trinova.org. Tim Murray, the executive director of the Pretrial Justice Institute, www.pretrial.org. Gentlemen, in the final minutes of the program, the final 10 minutes, I want to cut to the chase now. Okay, we've had a larger philosophical discussion. What I'm hearing is what you're saying, Tim, is that you want to see supervision upon release, and you want to see that the person released from pretrial incarceration from our jails throughout the country, that release decision should be made solely upon the person's level of dangerousness. So it's supervision and plus that conscious decision as to the degree of dangerousness. Do I have that correct?
Yeah, let me try and give you a very succinct answer. We have had the right to bail in this country since 1789. That accompanies our presumption of innocence. But as you've described it, many people see the crime occur. It's a slam dunk the crime occurred as by that particular defendant. It's not a shocking surprise to see the tremendously high conviction rate of those who are arrested. Cops arrest the right guy for the right reason most of the time. There are due process considerations which we all support and defend. In making the constitutional right of determining who is released pending trial, what I am advocating is base that decision on the risk of that defendant, not by the number of dollars he can get a hold of. And if that defendant poses a risk that is greater than the community's ability to manage it, then hold that defendant without the option for release and bring them to trial in a speedy manner.
Well, Marley, the other issue is that we have these wonderful tools now, and we've had 30 years of development trying to figure out who poses a clear and present risk to the public and who is an acceptable risk in terms of release on a pretrial basis, but they're not perfect.
Sure.
Even under the best of circumstances, the decisions that we within the criminal justice system make, some of them are going to blow up in our face. And then the victims community is going to, not just the victims community, but society in general is going to rightly sit back and say, well, what's up with this? I mean, don't you guys know what you're doing? I mean, so somewhere along the line, the victims community and society at large really has to give us a lot of leeway because we're going to get it right 95% of the time, but that other 5% is going to kill us.
Well, sure. And, you know, accountability works its way in there, hopefully appropriately so, because when things don't go as they should go, we naturally say, was there a gap? Does there need to be a change somewhere? Is there a policy change in view? I think what really gets us is when the system is designed to fail. Okay, when somebody gets out on bail and goes and injures children, for instance, like Tim was articulating in a recent story, a recent reality, we ask the question, well, okay, where was the gap? Well, when you discover the gap is built in, mm-hmm. the process is built in, that's what creates the greatest outrage for us. And victims, again, they're sensible people, and they say, you mean actually it wasn't based on risk assessment there, it was just based on money? And that's where we stop and say, no, wait a minute, come on, let's work on this. Nobody can solve this problem perfectly because we're humans. But if clearly there's a gap that we're either brushing it over or for other agenda reasons ignoring, that really becomes problematic.
Tim,
and that's what we're advocating.
Tim, we have a criminal justice system. I've been in it for over 40 years. You've been in it for quite some time. We're overburdened. We have high caseloads. We have literally thousands upon thousands of offenders entering and leaving the criminal justice system. We have severe budget cuts all throughout the United States. The local jails, as well as the prison systems, are basically saying that we're maxed out. We just don't have have the capacity to hold everybody that everybody wants us to hold. So there's almost, at times, almost a natural inclination. I mean, this isn't NASA. I mean, this is really dealing with thousands upon thousands of decisions. And you know, I mean, are we that precise? Are we that good within the criminal justice system that we can get it right the vast majority of times?
No, we're horrific in our decision-making because we're naming dollar amounts associated with individual charges, not even based on the background of the individual, but simply by what they're charged with. The way bail is set in this country, Len, from coast to coast, is judges have a card on the bench, and that card lists an offense, let's say car theft, and it names an amount, and that's what car theft costs in that jurisdiction. It doesn't matter if you're Jesse James or Mother Teresa, that's what it costs. And for the very reasons you've just articulated, the fact that we're in an economic downturn, the fact that public treasuries are smaller than they've been at any time in our lifetimes, we must make the best use of the resources available to our justice system. We must make the best decisions we can possibly make. It's time to throw away the archaic way of doing business of the last 150 years from an economic standpoint and from a fairness standpoint and from a safety standpoint. It is a win all around. Will it have failure? Absolutely it will. Is it foolproof? No, sir, it is not. Is it light years better than the system we currently suffer from? Undoubtedly.
Is it fair to say that both you gentlemen want an individual supervised, regardless of how they're released, whether it be monetary bond or whether it be by a pretrial services agency? You want them supervised regardless, correct? You want them to be held accountable, drug tested. You want them to check in with people.
Yeah, I mean there should be accountability when a person is charged with a crime. The level and nature of that, of course, is what we're considering. But, you know, any victim wants to know that the person that injured them is going to be held accountable. And even before the official court proceedings, you know, the official justice processes, we want to believe that, you know, their safety is still in view and they're being held, you know, in good measure. So, sure, absolutely.
So the bottom line
and is... I think that accountability goes... It reaches the justice professionals that staff our criminal justice systems throughout the country. And I don't believe that we have even come close to the kind of professional accountability with regard to victims that is essential to justice. I think victims, as I mentioned at the beginning of this show, are oftentimes simply pushed to the side by the system and by system actors. I think accountability extends not only to the defendant, but to the justice system as well. When a victim shows up at the door of pretrial services in a community and says, I got hit over the head last night. I hear the perpetrator is in court. Where do I go? They should get clear and concise and accurate information as to how to connect with victims' coordinators, how to reach the prosecutor's office before that court hearing, where and when that hearing will occur, and what their options are regarding the same. Just as they should have explained to them clearly and concisely what the defendant's obligations are, how he is to be held accountable if, in fact, he is released. I will argue with you, as long as you leave me on the air, that defendants who post money have done nothing but move cash from one pocket to another. Money does nothing to assure community safety. It simply separates those who have it from those who don't. And I don't believe money is part of this conversation in a meaningful way when it comes to determining pretrial release.
Well, you're not going to hear any disagreement from me, Tim, in terms of the fact that the criminal justice system really does need to. I mean, it just can't be a victim's coordinator. It has to be an entire fundamental change, and we have all of these federal and state constitutional amendments talking about what it is that we could do and what it is that we should do. I mean, these are mandates, but I think it's a philosophical philosophical understanding that you know, we have to do a much better job of protecting victims' rights. But from talking to practitioners, as you do, sometimes I just simply get the sense that we're exhausted by the process, and victims, it's like, oh my God, I just don't have the time to sit with this person for half an hour. I've got, you know, 1,000 other things to do. I sometimes feel that that's the dichotomy, a very overworked, overburdened, challenged criminal justice system that just lacks the penance, the wherewithal to give victims the sensitivity and the time that they deserve.
Yeah, but yeah. We're not talking about hand-holding. We're talking about delivering, as public servants, essential elemental services that individuals are guaranteed. Whether that guarantee comes under the Bill of Rights for the right to bail, or that comes as to the rights that each victim of crime has. We cannot turn our back on either set of rights. We are in the business of serving the public, and we have to get better and smarter and more effective at doing that job.
We're out of time, and one of the things that I do want to do, Will, let's do this again in a couple months, because I feel that we've barely scratched the surface on this issue, but I really am appreciative that you and Tim were coming on today and to discuss this whole issue of pretrial and victims' issues. It just needs further explanation, I think. But Will Marling, our guest today, Executive Director of National Organization for Victim Assistance, the web address for NOVA, www.trynova.org. Tim Murray, the executive director of the Pretrial Justice Institute, www.pretrial.org. Again, as I said at the beginning of the program, we've been asked to promote the National Reentry Resource Center, nationalreentryresourcecenter.org, a project of the U.S. Department of Justice, of the Office of Justice Programs, and the American Parole and Probation Association. Again, they do want you to respect and honor the sacrifice of parole and probation agents, what we call community supervision officers here in the District of Columbia, www.appa.net.org. Ladies and gentlemen, this is DC Public Safety. We really appreciate all of your calls and letters and interaction with us, and watch for us next time as we explore another very important topic in today's criminal justice system. Please have yourselves a very, very pleasant day.